Hey, welcome back. I'm Steve Mileto, your host of the Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 podcast. This is episode 55, and today I'm talking with Flip Flippin, and we're focused on capturing a child's heart. Flip is the founder and chairman of the Flippin Group, one of the fastest-growing educator training, corporate talent, and team development companies in North America. Flip is focused on helping kids and teachers be successful by changing behaviors and attitudes. He notes that, you know, at the beginning of the school year, we always pass out rule manuals, but we don't ever pass out a relationship manual. Today, he's going to talk about how we help kids understand that they are important to us. I think you're going to learn a lot. Enjoy.
They're not here for us. We're here for them. That's what it's about. Kids.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is all about assisting classroom teachers and school administrators to overcome the many walls or barriers that kids face. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is focused on helping you help kids achieve their dreams. As a note, I hope that you will stop by Stitcher or iTunes and leave me a star rating and a comment. That helps the show get noticed by more people. Thanks for listening and joining me week after week.
Welcome to the Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 podcast, bringing you ideas and resources for K-12 classrooms, schools, and school districts. Hosted by Steve Mileto. And now, here's Steve with this week's show.
Hey, welcome back. This is Steve with Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, and today I'm with Flip Flippin, who is the founder and chairman of the Flippin Group, and today I got a chance to listen to him speak, and he was awesome keynote, and you're going to learn a lot. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Flip is the founder and chairman of the Flippin Group, one of the fastest-growing educator training, corporate talent, and team development companies in North America. Flippin Associates give themselves relentlessly each day to building relationships and processes that bring out the best in people. Flip and his wife, Susan, who is CEO, were named Ernst & Young Entrepreneurs of the Year, the only couple to ever receive this prestigious award. The Flippin Group was chosen by Texas Monthly Magazine as the number two company to work for in the state of Texas. The company's breakthrough educational curricula and processes are used in thousands of schools nationwide, and their corporate division works with multinational and global companies around the world. Flip earned a bachelor's degree from Stephen F. Austin State University and a graduate degree from Texas A&M University. The first 16 years of Flip's professional life as a psychotherapist were spent working with gang kids. In the process, he built an outpatient clinic for at-risk youth and a 500-acre residential treatment facility for boys in College Station, Texas. Flip developed the theory of overcoming personal constraints, or OPC, to accelerate personal effectiveness by identifying and breaking debilitating behavior patterns that limit performance and hinder growth. Flip is recognized as one of the top leadership thought leaders in America. His first book, The Flip Side, Break Free of the Behaviors That Hold You Back, is available in 9 languages and became an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. With an emphasis on changing behaviors and attitudes that stand in the way of personal and team effectiveness, Flip presents keynote speeches and leadership development events worldwide. Flip and Susan live on their ranch in College Station, Texas, where Flip can be found working most weekends. And in their spare time, they also have helped raise 20 children. Flip, thank you so much for being with us today. Say hi to everybody.
Well, thanks, Steve. It's good getting to be with you. Appreciate this time.
Well, I appreciate you being here and taking some time with me. And what I'd like to do right now is just kind of get you to talk a little bit about your organization, the Flippin Group, what its mission is, what its purpose, and we'll go from there.
Well, I think you said it really well just in that introduction, which was gracious of you to say all those kind things, but it really is about bringing out the best in people. You know, we're one of the largest educator training companies in the world, and we work very heavy in corporate organizational executive development, so we work with a lot of multinational global companies, and you know, we travel a good bit all over the world working in organizations. We're heavy in the government space. We've done everything from run the ethics program at West Point through the CAPE Center to working in professional sports with the Yankees, Mets, Diamondbacks, Padres, and player development. So awesome. Our whole goal always comes down to the same thing, though. How do we help people go to the next level? And that's basically what we do.
That's awesome. You know, my audience is primarily teachers and principals, and so, you know, we're going to drive our discussion that way. But one of the things that I'd like you to get to just kind of talk about is, what set you about doing this? I mean, because I know I heard you today at when I heard you in your keynote talk, and just kind of what set you about this is a as your what you want to do to make a difference. I think I heard you say earlier today.
Well, I think that's a great question, Stephen. And honestly, I think more people ought to ask not what do people do, but why do they do it. And I appreciate you getting down to the heart of that. But Susan and I both we love kids, and actually we just love people. And I, you know, I've never found anybody that's fully optimized. There's nobody that I've ever met that is fully doing everything that they have the potential to do. And in fact, I had a quote I tweeted a while back that said, if you really want to astonish yourself and the world, live to your own potential.
Nice.
And so I really think it's just our love for kids. And Susan and I both had difficult childhoods in different ways. And I know what it takes to overcome obstacles, and I've watched kids do things that are amazing things, Steve, things that nobody would ever believe they have the ability to do. And, you know, so we wanted to build some processes that actually helped create those channels and opportunities for kids within the public school system.
Excellent. And one of the things that I heard you say today that, because it just resonates, and I think I told you earlier today that you just kind of set my brain on fire. I was writing profusely in my journal about some things that you got me thinking about, because one of the things that lots of educators will hear people talk about, and some of the educators are just awesome at doing, is connecting, but they may not really realize how important that is. And I heard you say mm-hmm. today that if I have a child's heart, I have his head. Can you kind of let's kind of open and proceed with that. And I know I'm kind of jumping into the middle of your world.
That's good. That's good, Steve. But it's true. If you have a child's heart, you have his head. And it's interesting that, you know, in education, like at the first of every school year, we pass out a discipline manual, but we don't ever pass out a relationship manual.
You're right.
And we don't, you know, we say, here are the rules, but we don't sit down and allow us as educators and as people who work and love children to be able to say, well, okay, here's how we go about loving them. Here's how we go about conveying to them how they are important to us, how what we do because we love these kids. And so we focus more on the rules than we do on the relationship. And I spent, as you noted there, the first 16 years working with gang kids. The kids I worked with were not the kids that were in school. They were the kids that were in jails and prisons and on the streets. Many of them were highly successful, but they were highly successful at running underground organizations. Everybody from the head of the Mexican Mafia in Texas, which is no small group, as you well know, and to a lot of incarcerated people, and people that ultimately became either murdered or incarcerated. And you can't, I see people, they'll threaten kids or they'll actually bully them. I mean, they'll think they're going to intimidate them or they're going to force a kid to do something. And I'll just tell you, Steve, there's no teacher inside public education is going to do something to a kid that has not already been done to him in spades someplace else. So when you start threatening kids that come out of difficult backgrounds, it's a waste of time. You're like, I've been there, done that. I mean, right. What are you going to do to me? You can't shoot me. And the things sometimes that you might want to do would send you to jail anyway. So
which would be bad.
There's got to be another way.
Nice. Let's kind of get into some specifics about, and I thank you so much for sharing that, because I do have to make sure I reflect on that just a little bit before I go forward. To me, what's so magic about teaching that a lot of people outside of the teaching world don't get is that you're working with kids.
That's right.
And the kids come in all different shapes and sizes and attitudes and backgrounds. And it actually is a neat sort of challenge to figure out how to connect with them. And I think some of the most magic educators that I've ever run into understand that, and they see the ones who put up more walls than the others as a challenge to try and help. I'm going to reach you yet. One of the things I used to try and do is make somebody laugh. Come on, man, that was funny, you know. And you know, if I'm trying to get them to calm down or whatever, and I've had some educators who were awesome at that. You know, I'm thinking of one particular teacher right now who, she worked with some of the kids who are angry at the world and don't even understand why they're angry, and she could put her arm around their shoulders and get them to, fine, okay, and eventually, you know, sit back down and lose their anger about whatever they were angry about. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know is, I mean, she could, you know, fuss with their hair, and and it was the neatest thing. And then she could get them to care about, and she taught world history, all right? Yep. She taught history classes. I'm a history teacher, and getting kids to care about it, and then kids who don't care about, you know, is already a challenge, but then kids who don't care about school, period, getting them to care about that, that's a huge thing. Plus, she's able to calm them down. And it's so cool what you're talking about, learning those techniques and strategies and about connecting with kids, you know, and getting back to what you said, that capturing their heart is so important. And I just love this message that you send.
Well, it's you know, it's very, very true, Steve. As I talked about this morning in the keynote, there's a thing called tacit knowledge. And those are the things that we know, but we don't know that we know them.
Yes.
They can't be easily codified or written down. And, you know, for example, virtually every woman on the planet knows, they feel when somebody's looking at them. Well, how can you feel somebody looking at you? Yet it's an undeniable fact that virtually every woman has had that experience. We intuit certain things. They're things we're aware of. And the same is very true of children, because they have far less power. They have far less command of what happens to them. They have much less control. And so they're constantly reading all of these signals around them. They know when they're safe and when they're not safe. They know who they're safe with and who they're not safe with. Exactly, and Steve, as odd as this sounds, there's a great book out there, The Gift of Fear. But we pick up on these very subtle cues as to whether or not we are safe with a certain person or in a certain situation. And children are acutely attuned to those things without even knowing that they're picking up on them. So the teachers that are really, really good, those are the teachers. Now, I'm not talking about the teachers that cut them slack and don't push them to be their best. I'm not talking about being their best buddy. But it's the teachers that have the ability to connect with kids, where the kids want to talk to them about things that maybe they've not ever shared with anybody else. And oftentimes it's their smile, it's their laugh, it's their ability to reach out and touch them on the shoulder. It's the little things that they say to them when they walk by. We know, for example, that if a teacher walks by a student and she puts his hand on his shoulder and just touches him on the shoulder, we know that that relaxes that child's brain. We know that. We know there's some great research out that we know that if children in elementary school hold hands before they take a standardized test, their scores are higher. You know, why is that? What is it about touch, this sense of connectivity? Why is laughter so important? I mean, I'll give you another wild fact. Do you know that a boy and a girl, 16, 17, 18, 20, 25, 30, 35, whatever age, but if they sit down and they begin to talk and they turn towards each other and they smile two or three times in synchronization at the same kind of comment within the first 2 to 3 minutes, and there's some fundamental attraction there, do you know their heartbeats synchronize?
Oh, my gosh.
Now, people, they would say, that can't be. Well, go read Malcolm Gladwell's book about it. He talks about it extensively. I told my wife that. She said, that can't be. I said, honey, I said it can't be. She said, honey, it is totally true. Think about all the great poetry. And their hearts beat as one. We know when people like us. We know it.
Right.
And kids pick up on it super quick.
It is, this area that you're talking about is just so amazing, because I think we miss out on this important, because there's this world that's taught. I mean, it's taught everybody that every touch is bad, and you know, therefore
that's not true.
Right. Therefore, a teacher shouldn't touch them on the shoulder, shouldn't do whatever, you know, and it's exactly the opposite, because that's not the reality of the world. I think the news media and sorry if I offend people, but the ambulance chasers of the world who chase that buck to sue somebody have made it into the world as if everybody in education is this way, therefore no touching is appropriate. And it's unfortunate because, you know, it's funny, I've learned that same thing. You know, sometimes we just need a hug. And I'll share with you, because of the training that I've had over the years, I used to not hug people. I come from a hugging family, right? My Italian family,
an advantage. I didn't.
I did. I come from a hugging family. My dad hug you, you know, drop me off at school. He's going to kiss me on the cheek. And, you know, as a teenager, I'm like, Dad, okay, I got all these kids watching me, all right? And, you know, and it's, I wish he was here now. But I had all that as part of my world. And, you know, and he'd give me a hug and say, hey, have a great day, kiddo, and all that sort of stuff. Well, as I got into, you know, military, they're big on, you know, don't touch, you don't, you know, it's this, the fraternization can't happen, and teaching all that stuff that'll get you in trouble there. And then you get into education, and because of lawmakers making the rules, which I really would love to get you to talk a little bit about, you got into something earlier today that I love. It just hits a note right there, on nail on the head. By the way, I screw up saying, so if I do that to you, I just did it here. Hits the nail on the head. Boy, that was a hard saying to remember. You know, it's but it's one of those things that what happened to me, though, along the way, is that I learned that, you know, you just got to be so careful that people don't take offense to what you say or that it's misinterpreted. So, for example, commenting that someone's dressed nicely, I may not say that because I'm a little worried that you're going to be misinterpreted. Now I'm not talking about kids. I'm talking about adult interactions. When my father passed away, it sent me into into another planet for a while. And mm-hmm. I was real close with him, and he died of complications of Parkinson's. And so over a period of time, I lost my father earlier than his actual death. And when he actually did pass away, I kind of locked myself away from people for a while, even though I was in the building, even though I'm walking down the hallways and talking, I'm not the same goofball that they were used to. And one day this group of teachers came to me and they said, we'd like to talk to you. And I said, sure, what's up? And they said, we know you don't hug, but we know you need a hug. So you're not getting out of this office. We're all giving you a hug. And I went, okay. And evidently when they came to hug me, I stood there with my arms down my side. And they said, no, you have to hug us back. Mm-hmm. And I said, fine. And it was amazing because I'm telling the story, just getting back to what you're talking about. Adults need that connection. And that helped me tremendously in trying to kind of recover from that impact, because it had, you know, just happened. And
yeah, well, so, that's true, Steve. You know, we don't, you know, and I have a hard time with lawyers writing the laws that govern how we teach. And, you know, lawyers are not traditionally known to be the warmest and fuzziest of human beings, although I happen to love my attorney. He's a great guy. But the fact is, we don't need to legislate that. You know, we need to be able to talk about what's appropriate and not appropriate. And of all the professions that have close contact with children, teachers have the lowest incidence of inappropriate contact with children. And we forget that because the papers explode the news over it. We have 60 million kids in this country. And you know, at certain times, there's going to be things that happen that they don't happen. But that should not indict or control or direct the behaviors of all the rest of us. You know, look, I love my kids. We've taken in and raised 18 additional kids to our two biological ones. And I love my kids. I hug them, kiss them every day. And they all know it. But you know what's interesting is that when our boys and were playing sports, I'd be down on the field hugging and kissing my sons. The boys that were without dads, they would be right there in line for the same thing. And of course, I do that. I hug on them and we celebrate. And that's one of the reasons why I think contact sports is so important to kids. You know, we see them out there banging around each other, high-fiving and hugging, and they're doing shoulder bumps. And you know, it's a very physical environment. We see children in school hugging and touching all the time. It could be inappropriate or appropriate, but they're very social creatures. They need touch. And if we're not able, if we're restricted in a way that we can't appropriately convey to children how deeply we care for them and their well-being, we're losing one of the greatest tools that we've got in education. And that's why I want teachers at the door shaking their hands, because that's a point of contact. Nobody's going to have a problem with that. And it won't take but a week, maybe even a few days. You'll be touching them on the shoulder while you're doing that, walking around the classroom, touching their space, touching their books. There are all kinds of ways to convey concern, commitment, compassion. It's critical to learning. And Steve, not to belabor this, but from a neurological point of view, if you just look at the fMRIs that are coming out, you see how it relaxes their brain. It actually switches on the amygdala, which gives us access to the hippocampus, which means that their learning is going to take place. And if you're not opening those neural pathways, then don't talk to me about why they don't learn. I know they don't learn. You didn't turn the switch on.
Nice.
We have to do that.
We do. That's awesome. And before we leave this, because you spent a lot of time with us earlier today on this, and I don't have any charts in front of people, although I will include a picture of it, but let's make sure that we touch back on the two of those words that you just used, which is amygdala.
Yep, yep.
And hippocampus.
That's right.
Right? They're parts of the brain.
Well, that's right. So it comes up your brain stem, which is the primal brain. It's at the top of your spinal cord and the base of your brain. And right on top of the brain stem is this primitive part, the limbic system. And there are two structures in there called the amygdala and the hippocampus. And the amygdala is this switching mechanism. You would know it as fight or flight. We now know there's also a freeze spot in there where it actually goes to neutral. So it's either on, off, or in neutral position. Well, the thing that turns it on is when children feel safe. If you want to turn it off, all you do is you threaten them or you create a high-stress environment. We have so many kids today that they're coming. In fact, the most recent data is 25% of kids in public school today during the day receive and feel and report high levels of personal stress, threat, insecurity. Well, if that's true, and that could be from a look, it could be from cyberbullying, it could be a broken relationship, it could be a conflict with a teacher, it could be anything. But we know the minute that switch gets flipped to the off position, they can't get to the hippocampus. Well, the hippocampus, I always say, the hippo, the biggest building on the campus, is the library. And so that's where short-term memory and process memory takes place. Well, if you're teaching something and you can't get it to short-term memory, you can't get it to long-term memory, which means you can't get it back on a test. So it honestly would be like I'm talking to you right now and we hit a button and I'm still talking, but the switch is off and nobody's hearing it. Well, how in the world do I fault you then for not getting it?
Right.
I'm the one that hit the switch that turned it off. So that's what it does.
Gotcha. I appreciate you explaining that because it just makes I think when people understand a little bit more, I think that's one of the things that's missing. And I'm going to use this to kind of go into something else that I heard you say today. It's unfortunate that a lot of people are ahistorical. They don't understand a little bit about the past that can help them learn about the future. And it doesn't have to be that far in the past to actually be something that can teach them a little bit. In the 1890s, Francis Parker wrote a book called Pedagogy. And this is in the 1890s. I think he published it in 1893. And in the opening chapter, he has a statement where he says, an enemy to education, and I'm paraphrasing, by the way, is a teacher who doesn't read. And what he's talking about is a classroom teacher who's not learning more about how kids think.
Yeah.
And what I think is ironic, by the way, is that's in the 1890s. I think they still may have been doing lobotomies then, or electric shock or something. And and he's talking about something that's very real, which is... I guess that's a crazy thing to say. Yes, it was very real. The idea that we need to learn more. And I actually heard you say today something that just, I mean, you in my journal, if you were to read it, I went off on all kinds of writing when you said this, which was you made the comment that I work with teachers every day who want to teach but don't want to learn. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Well, I think, and it's not, that's not just teachers either. I mean, it's in the corporate world. It's in the sports world. And you take an athlete, for example, who's very talented and gifted, but if they're uncoachable, they're not going to go to the next level. And I see a lot of teachers that they're very talented and gifted teachers, but they're not coachable. They refuse to change different things. So it's not just limited to, our profession or the passions that we have, but it's across the board. So here's the thought. Let's see, you want to teach, but you don't want to learn. You want to test, but you don't want to be assessed. And for me, I'm assessed every day. I mean, I had to give a keynote. I got the opportunity to do that this morning. You know, I give many of them, but I'm continually getting feedback. And if I'm not learning and improving and developing new material and studying new things, then I have nothing to offer the people that are in front of me. If you're sitting here saying, well, I teach the same material every day. Well, really? But kids are not the same. School is not the same. The right. process is not the same. The environment's not the same. The culture's not the same. The influences are not the same. The music's not the same. Their learning styles are not the same. I mean, today the number of stimuli that hit a child at any one given point in time is exponentially higher than it was just 10 years ago, let alone 50 years ago. If the average age of the teacher today is 52, then you've got to stop and think, wow, I bet in the last 20 years things have changed fairly dramatically. And sure enough, they have.
Just a little bit.
You know, so yeah, you know, I think if you want to teach, you've got to be a learner. There's no question about it.
I love it. That's, you know, that is so true. And I think you made a great point that it's in any part of our world. It's not just education.
Right. You've got to be coachable.
You have to be coachable. You have to, I mean, I think in anything, when you see businesses collapse and fail, usually something that's a key part of it of that collapse is that they didn't want to move forward, and or they, you know, they're not looking at where the rest of the world's going, and they're going to stick to their guns and whatever their program is. And I like that. You got to be teachable. Let's use this to kind of touch on something else that you said, and then I want to go into some tenets of the programs that you actually, when you come in and you work with, that are available to schools. One of the things I want to make sure that I get you to talk just briefly about is this: anxiety or stress levels in students in the classroom. You got into, I know this is huge and I'm asking you to narrow it down for me, but the idea that the more stress that a kid has, the less likely they are to really do well in school.
Well, it's very true, and it goes back to that switching mechanism that's right there. You know, it's fascinating that, you know, if you ever play a sport or if you ever have an event or a competitive occurrence or something that you have to perform well on, there's this anticipatory stress. You get geared up for the game, if you will. Well, that's called eustress. It's the positive side of stress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S. Which, by the way, did you know that stressed, spelled backwards, is desserts?
No, did not know that. And that's interesting.
I really think that, you know, sometimes we just need a little sugar on that side. Donut will cure a multitude of ills. But once it hits, once the stress gets too high, it breaks, and then it becomes distress. And distress drops performance pretty dramatically. But the thing that we've learned from all this is that now, because we can actually look at a functioning brain, so instead of doing a static magnetic resonance image, an MRI, we can do what's called a functional magnetic resonance image. So it's a functional fMRI is what it's called. And we can actually see what parts of the brain light up doing certain activities. So I'll give you a really simple one. There's some great research on this that you can Google. But they took subjects and they shocked them. They randomly shocked them. And the shock had low amperage and high voltage, and it hurt like a son of a gun. And then what they did, and of course they stuck them in the MRI tube, and they ran the studies, and they could see what parts of the brains were exploding while they were being shocked. And of course, you don't know when you're going to get shocked.
Right.
So your anxieties are up, et cetera. Well, while they were doing it, they thought, I wonder what would affect this. So they had them, before they went in the tube, lay their right arm outside the tube. So they've extended their arm up above their head. They slide them into the tube, and they have their spouse come and sit with them and hold their hand.
Wow.
Now, this is a fact, Steve. It lowered the response to the exact same or higher levels of shock. It lowered the response over 50% simply because somebody cared for you was holding your hand. Now, if that's true in such a radically controlled environment, you just stop and think about it. But this is not new material. We all know we do better when we're not alone.
Right.
We all know we do better when we're connected. The thing that lowers the 16 risk factors in kids, the one single factor that's been proven over and over and over again, is a deep, meaningful, connected relationship with an appropriate adult. It doesn't say parent. It doesn't say police officer. It doesn't say school counselor. It says a deep, meaningful, connected relationship with an appropriate adult. And that so equips children and, quite candidly, all of us. I mean, you lost your dad. I've lost both of my parents. We're not through losing people. There are going to be more deaths and catastrophes around us this year. I want to tell you something. I don't want to go through them alone. I want to walk through those things with somebody that cares about me, that comes to me, that holds me, that hugs me, that cries with me, that cares for me. And because of that, I know that I will not get depressed to the degree that I could be. I know I will respond better to it. I know I will recover quicker. I know my immune system will not deplete as rapidly. I will decrease the rate at which I get sick. I will sleep better. I mean, it's just too much research out on it now. It's used to, they'd say, well, this is kumbaya, whatever. And it's like, really? Seriously? How come that my kids outperform your kids? And the reason is because they're cared for deeply. I don't care what they smell like, where they come from, who the parents are, how much money they make, what color they are, what their background is. My passion, my privilege is to be able to love and care for children. If they're in front of me, they're mine.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Because in a second, we're going to connect all this to you in the classroom. And I just think that is so powerful in helping educators understand a little bit about what they're trying to do in the school building and in the classroom to help kids be able to be, you know, when people talk about being successful and achieving and so forth, there's other parts that have to be there in order to help that go along. And just like you said, and you know, if I'm going through something painful, well, it's also something that's tough for me. You need somebody there with you that, you know, can support you. I thank you so much. Well, let's use this as a jumping point to talking about your program. I mean, I've heard about this concept that you have about kind of getting the developing a contract with the kids and getting the school into this level of getting the kids to be an active part of their school, and four questions that go with that. Can you talk a little bit about?
Yeah, we can. You know, my belief is that the more connected kids are, the better they do, the higher they perform. So the question is how do you build community? Well, many, many years ago, I just took it upon myself to visit a lot of different schools. And one of the questions that I asked, and I'm not talking about in 10 or 12 classrooms, Steve. I've visited tons of schools. I asked thousands of kids, can you tell me the name of every person in your classroom? And at the middle school level, I did not find one school that could do it. Now, I'm not talking about a school with 10 kids in it. Right. I'm talking about, you know, kind of the average size school, 600 kids or more on a single campus. And so as I looked at that, I thought, they don't even know who they're sitting in class with. So then the question is how do you build community? Well, one of the things we know is that if I tell you what to do, at some point you're going to push back on that. You know, Steve, why don't you sit up straight and pick up your room and do the dishes and take out the trash and feed the dog and do your homework and hang up your clothes? And why don't you not eat with food in your mouth and your mouth open? Why don't you just correct? Right. If I tell you the rules, at some point kids are going to push back on that. So is there a way for us to teach them self-governance instead of me governing them? When I was in Russia, I was speaking about this very concept, and one of the Russian teachers said, in our country, we tell them what to do, and they do that. If they don't do it, then we deny them access to the university. And I said, well, that's true, but if you can't teach self-governance, and Steve, I said this, if you can't teach self-governance, then you deserve another Stalin.
Awesome comment.
Well, it was a very impacting statement for the several thousand teachers there, because he's responsible for the death of 23 million Russians, as you well know.
Most definitely, and could be easily a direction they're going right now.
No, very much so. And so this idea of self-governance is a privilege in our country. So we developed a concept of letting children write the contract for their classroom.
Nice.
And so there are a set of questions we go through. The first one the teacher would say is, how do you want me to treat you? Well, you know, kids have got strong opinions on how they want that, you know. And then the other questions that we could talk about, but I'll give away the sauce, you know. But the bottom line is what I want's a contract then that all the kids sign, and that they learn how to enforce it upon themselves. So they're actually learning how to manage their own behaviors in a classroom so we can create a self-governing classroom. Now, of course, whenever that begins to crack a little bit and not work like it should, the teacher is able to say, you know, guys, look, here are the rules y'all wrote. If we don't want to follow those, I can put mine back in place. Kids don't want that. They do want to learn how to govern themselves. Right. And so there are processes to be able to teach that. Children don't know how to self-assess. You know, I love the fact that I'm not losing my hair, except my boys tell me to slip around back. It's getting thin. But here's the problem, Steve. I can't slip around back. I can't fully self-assess by myself. I can't be fully self-aware by myself. It's an oxymoron. I need feedback from other people so that I can get insight into my behavior. That's the only way we get better. And so I wanted to create a high-functioning classroom that would do that. Now we've done that, you know, in thousands and thousands of classrooms and schools, thousands of schools all across the country. And it's marvelous to watch it.
That is awesome. Tell us a little bit of how would is it through a school system or through a school? At what level is it that people contact your group to establish connection?
Well, it's both. Yeah, it's both. We, you know, what we really want to do is what we call district by design. But if it's on a particular campus, then we can easily do the program there. We want to do them district wide because, you know, if your feeder pattern is such that these kids are learning this and then they go to the next level and they're not getting it there, then what you're doing is increasing variability. So let me touch on that a second. You see, if I walk down the hall and every fourth teacher is unhappy or disgruntled or upset or disappointing me with a different model, then I've got variability in the system. If the way that I behave out of a classroom, catch that, Steve, the teacher didn't throw him out of the classroom. The teacher didn't send him to the office. The kid behaved his way out of the classroom. He behaved his way into the principal's office.
Right.
Now, the question is how does he behave his way back into the classroom? I want a process for that so that every teacher understands I'm not the perpetrator. I didn't send you to the principal's office, sweetheart. You sent yourself. You behaved your way there. I need you to behave your way back because I'm missing you.
I love that.
I want you back. But I want the entire system operating on the exact same platform so that there's no variability in the system. And of course, that reduces variability in outcomes. So I want behaviors aligned. I want us doing the same process. Now, does that mean I want everybody looking the exact same? No, I don't. Do I want them behaving very much the same way? Yes, I do. I actually do. And if you're not comfortable with that, I need you to change. I need you to smile. I need you to be happy. I need you to be okay touching kids. I need you to be able to shake their hands. I need you to start every class with good things. Let's start on a positive note. Let's create an environment where kids are raising their hands about what they don't know, which is the ultimate test of security. It's not how quick they raise their hands about the things they do know, and then you got three or four kids with their hand in the air. It's when kids are saying, I don't understand that. But kids don't say that because of social anxiety, because they're not safe.
Right.
So how do we reverse that and create this safe environment where they do get it and they are comfortable saying, excuse me, how do we have a clue? What are we talking about? And the rest of the kids don't laugh. But they actually can say, I can help. And they scoot their chair over there and they help that kid. And Steve, don't think this is a myth, because we've got tens of thousands of schools and classrooms doing this very thing.
That is awesome. I got to tell you, I know you don't have time for this, because I could talk to you for hours. So I got to tell you that it's just amazing what you're talking about. And what I'd like to do right now is, where could people find out more information so that they'd like to pursue more information about you and your organization and actually connecting with you, whether through social media or a website or whatever? Where can they find this connection? And then I got three questions I want to try and sneak in here at the end. But where can they find that connection? Because I know, like, on, they can just look, find your book, The Flip Side, is out there, but you have more than just that book. You have your organization. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how they can
connect
with
it's easy. I mean, with a name like Flip Flippin', good gracious, how hard is that to Google, you know?
You pop right up, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's somewhat of a curse. In fact, I found out in second grade what my legal name was, and I got sent to the nurse's office because I was crying. I was so shocked. I thought I had a real name. What are you talking about? No, they can just Google Flip Flippin', or they can look up the Flippin' group, and then we've got staff in this area that can get in touch with you really easy. And
nice.
It's a very easy process. We've got one goal, Steve, and that's serving you guys.
That's awesome. I will include in the show notes, I'll include links to your website and to the different places to find you, as well as your different works and so forth. Mm-hmm. This is just amazing what you're talking about here, and you know, it's such a key to changing the environment of a school.
And thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, let me sneak in my final questions. And,
sure.
And what I'd like to do is ask you, if you were standing in front of 100 brand new teachers, they're just getting ready to go into the classroom, they've never been there yet, what one piece of advice would you give them?
Oh, you have to capture their hearts. You do. One of the things to do, there are actually two parts to this. One is tell why you teach. Tell why you teach. What made you teach? Why are you standing in front of those kids? And if you can't answer that question, it needs to be your last year to teach.
Awesome.
You need to be able to walk down the street and get a good job. It'll just reward you in great ways. But you've got to be able to say why. And the second thing is you have to tell your story. Children want to know you. They don't know adults. I want you to share your story. This is who I am. This is where I came from. This is my mom and dad. These are my brothers and sisters. Here's my dog. Here's my spouse. Here's my family. So that children know you and can be connected with you. And part of that, Steve, is that you want to know their stories. Now, that doesn't mean first day, okay, every kid stand up and introduce yourself. You know, that's terrifying for most of those kids, and it becomes a glib exercise. But for you to find ways to learn the stories of the children in your classroom, because once you express a personal interest in that child, they will tell you their story. And their life is their story, believe me. Those are the things.
Thank you very much. Very powerful. So let's switch it to principals. If you
sure.
were talking to 100 principals who are in their buildings and they're getting ready, they've come to hear you, and you've only got, you know, people have asked you, just tell them one thing, and then...
Well, it's going to sound terrible, but it's the same thing. Steve, it's the same thing. You know, we forget that our life really is our story, and we don't share it. We don't share it. I mean, today, right after the keynote this morning, a superintendent came up and said, you know, Flip, I too came from a difficult background. I too have a learning disability. And I said, do your teachers know that? Well, no, it's not something I'm proud of. I need you to know that the broken places are the beautiful places. People connect to us when they know that, look, we're as ordinary can be. And we long for connectivity. We long to understand and know other people. Every person, Steve, deeply has a desire to be truly and completely known. And here's the second part. Being known, we really have a deep desire to be accepted. Our fear is that if people really know us, they won't accept us. Well, here's the thing. Don't let your fear control your life. Give yourself away. Give yourself away. It's not going to kill you, believe me.
That's awesome. This is why, you know, those of you listening, this is why, I mean, I said earlier my mind was on fire. I mean, I just, you got me thinking, and I wish I'd run into you at the beginning of my career instead of where I am, although I can make sure that this
You've got a lot of miles left. You've got a lot of miles left.
The final thing that I'd like to ask you is, if in your past, when you were in school, K through 12, is there a teacher that, if you could thank them, that made an impact on you? Is there an educator that you would say thank you to? Who would that be, and what would you say to him?
Oh my gosh, actually there's several. There are five teachers that I think about a good bit. I mean, You know, Steve, I've had a lot of successes. And I mean, I've been all over the world multiple times and done a bunch of cool things. And in that sense, I've had an amazing life. The things that people on this end of my life don't realize how hard the first part was. And being, illegitimate, being unwanted, feeling horribly unloved, feeling incredibly ignorant because I have a learning disability. I still don't know my multiplication tables. And the good news is I can hire somebody to do them for me today. But you know, it's easy to look now and say, oh, wow, well, you just had such a great upbringing. And in some ways I did because of good friends and stuff. But, you know, I had Miss Margaret Kirkendall, I had Joe Beneke, and I had Miss Kantz, and I had Miss Gresham, I had Miss Meeks, these teachers. It wasn't what they taught. They were good teachers. They certainly were competent and capable teachers. But it wasn't that. It's that they cared for me. They cared about me. And when you're a boy that grows up in a home that's never been hugged, and you see your siblings being hugged, and you don't understand why you're not being hugged because you don't know the origins of your birth, you don't know some of your history, and then a teacher does hug you, it's like, oh my gosh. You know, and she hugged me for no reason other than to just tell me that I was a good boy and she was proud of me. And, you know, we negate the importance of these very small things. And I know when my Latin teacher did that. Now think about this. I get out fourth from the bottom of my high school, and I'm taking Latin. Ask me what kind of Latin student I was. I was a great Latin student because I loved Miss Kantz.
Nice.
I'd have cut my arm off for her, and to this day, she's long gone. Hazel Fennell, my sixth grade teacher, is still alive, and she's quite old now, and I sent her a note not long ago telling her that she is adored to the deepest levels and depths of my heart. And there's no way. Everything I've ever done is because of them, Steve. Every car I drive, where I live, the children I raise, the job I have, everything in my entire life traces to those teachers. So with tears running down my face, I would be saying thank you, thank you, thank you for giving me my life.
Awesome. The power of teachers who care. The power of the classroom. Flip, thank you so very much for your time. I greatly appreciate everything that you spent with me, and I know I've gone way beyond the amount of time that I should have, and I'm sorry.
That's good,
but
Steve.
I could
thank
spend
you.
Hours
thank
with you.
Thank you so much.
But thank you, and I got to, anyone listening to this, you got to check them out. I'll have all the links in the show notes, and check out learning a little bit more about the Flippin' Group and what lessons it can help you with in connecting with kids. Thanks.
Hello, listeners. We want to remind everyone to check out all of our digital content at teachinglearningleadingk12.com. That's teachinglearningleadingk12.com. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Just search Teaching Learning Leading K-12 in the iTunes store. Check back often for updates and new material.
Hang tight, everyone. I'm going to let go of the wall.
You have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, recorded in Eastman, Georgia, at the heart of Georgia Precinct.